It's the 19th hole with Michael Williams.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the 19th hole. I'm your host, Michael Williams, bringing you the very best of the best of the very best in golf and golf lifestyle. And in golf, there was nothing that's bigger this week than the Ryder Cup. It was contested at Bethpage Black in New York. It was an epic tournament. It was an epic event. I think it even exceeded the expectations for drama, for play, for what happened on the course, and sadly for what happened off the course. There was so much to talk about, so much to absorb and reflect on from this tournament, and looking forward already, even in the middle of the final round, they were looking at what it meant to the upcoming Ryder Cup at Adair Manor in Ireland. It's just a never-ending cycle now with the Ryder Cup. I have to say, it's even bigger in some ways than the major championships because everyone pays attention to it. Golf fans pay attention to the majors. Sports fans pay attention to the Ryder Cup. It was really something to see. I was fortunate enough to be there for a good deal of it. And I will give you my views and opinions both on the play, the players, the event itself, the golf course, and of course, the spectators and fans and the unfortunate events that happened all around the golf course during the course of the event. There's so much to talk about, so much to go over. Joining me today will be one of my very, very favorite golf reporters and one of my very favorite people, to be perfectly honest. Adam Shupak of Golf Week will be joining us to talk about and break down the 2025 Ryder Cup. He was there for the entire thing, the entire week, saw all of it unfold in front of him and in front of us, and he will give you his complete insider's report on what happened, why it happened, and what we can expect to see next in Ireland. He's got a great perspective, and I just love talking to him, and I'm sure you love listening to him. So much to say. So when we come back, I'm going to give you my view of what I saw in New York. And the good, the bad, and the ugly, to coin a phrase, of the Ryder Cup 2025. I'm going to give it to you. So go get yourself a cold beverage, a crunchy snack, settle in, and we will be right back with Ryder Cup 2025. Michael Williams, 19th hole.
Hello, this is Gary Player. I'm listening to Michael Williams, the best, on the 19th hole.
Welcome back to the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host. There's so much to talk about with the Ryder Cup. There always is. Whether the USA wins, whether Europe wins, no matter where it's contested, there's always so much to go over. So I'm going to try to touch on the things in two categories. One, on the course, the players, how they did, the course and the course as well. And then we'll focus on what happened off the course a little bit and talk a little bit about what were some of the unfortunate events. I think they were unfortunate. A lot of people don't, quite frankly, but I think they were unfortunate for golf in terms of the behavior of the fans there. Was it unexpected? We'll get into that. But first, let's talk about the players. And when we talk about the play at this Ryder Cup, I think the first place you have to go is into the first 2 days of competition, the group play, because the Europeans played at a level that was rarely seen before. If we can say if ever seen before. And the first place you have to go in examining an appreciation of this type of play, this type of performance, is the captain. Luke Donald did a superior job preparing each one of his players for this particular course, mentally, physically, and also in combining them in ways that would make them the most effective over the 2 days, to split up his best players, his best performers at certain times, and putting them together at other times. You get guys like Tommy Fleetwood, who is, I think, not my MVP. If we break this down into how we used to do it in Little League football, you have a most valuable player and a most outstanding player. Your most outstanding player was Tommy Fleetwood. I went 4-1-0 through the tournament. He played spectacularly. He played beautifully. He just narrowly lost to Justin Thomas on Sunday, missing the chance to go 5-0. But he was clearly, to me, the best player at Bethpage. He played with precision. He played with style. He played with reckless abandon. He put together five rounds of golf, I think, that were as good or better than any I have ever seen in Ryder Cup play. He was absolutely spectacular. But then you get to who I think was your most valuable player, and that is, of course, Rory McIlroy. Rory finished 3-1-1 over the tournament, but it's not just the fact that he played well, because he certainly did play well, despite his loss by one hole to the world number one. Number one and number two for the first time in Ryder Cup history, you had Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy. And McIlroy lost by one hole. He went beyond playing well. What he had to endure on the course was as bad or worse as anything I've ever seen anyone have to endure. It was unbelievable. Some of the things that were thrown at him, some of the things that were said to him. I've known Rory personally for quite some time now, over 15 years. And I have to say, he is one of the most thoughtful, polite persons I have ever met. He is introspective. He is not a person to non-self-aggrandizing. He doesn't build himself up. He rather questions himself and his actions all the time. This is what he does, probably to a fault. This is something that Tiger never did. Tiger was firmly of the opinion that because I win, I am right. And because I am right, I win. And rinse and repeat. That was his thought process. And it served him very, very well through a career that is widely considered to be the best ever. Rory is a different guy. Despite all this, and despite the fact that he is loved by the average fan, when they go to see him in golf tournaments all over, including the Masters, which just got completed this year. He just completed the Career Slam, and you have people in tears shouting, "Rory, Rory, Rory," adoring this man for his career, his lifetime achievements, and his achievement at the course on that day. The same people showed up to Bethpage and treated him like, just like dog. It was unbelievable. And I think my phone is trying to beat me out with things I want to say. He was absolutely crucified by the crowd there. But despite that, he played at an extremely high level and served as a captain on the field, if you will, for Luke Donald and the other captains. He controlled himself when he needed to. He let himself go when he needed to, and he did an absolutely fantastic job. Justin Rose. I mean, you go down the line, Justin Rose, McIntyre, John Rahm, all of these guys just played spectacularly in these first 2 days. And it's not that the U.S. played bad. The U.S. played fantastically well those first 2 days. They just got beat by an absolute juggernaut, which brings us to day two. And with day three, you get the singles matches and you have this huge lead of 7 points, 12-5 after the the halving of the point with Victor Hovland, which I have no problem with. It's a sportsman's game, and somebody can't play, and you give them the half point. I have no problem with it. Everybody knew that that was the case, so if it was close, it wouldn't have been a big deal. If it was a runaway like it was, it's not a big deal. It just happens, okay? Fine. So that's what I have to say about that. But the U.S. players came out with an attitude like, look, we're out of this thing. Let's just go for it. They played with a calm and a reckless abandon that served them well. And they almost pulled it off. You had the first two matches go out, and you had Cameron Smith, who was the U.S. MVP, absolutely. He played magnificently throughout the entire week. Played like he played at that course before, although the course itself didn't play like it ever had before. He played like he'd been there before. But you had Justin Thomas go out and win. You had Cameron go out and win. And then that sort of freed up everybody else to go out and do what they did. And they almost pulled it off, but they didn't quite pull it off. Because you had, even though you had only one win, think about it, one win on Sunday by the European team, they still managed to pull off the win with 15 points, the full entire win. I think it was an epic matchup. It was a great matchup. And if there was any one thing that contributed to me to the Europeans winning this match, it was the course and the way it was set up. This is, of course, up to the captain, the U.S. captain, Keegan Bradley, to set up the course like he wants it to be set up. And he's played there lots of times. He's a St. John's guy. He knows New York. He's from New England, the North. He knows Bethpage very, very well. And he knew what he wanted to set up. And what he set up, to me, was Augusta Light. It was, of course, it had a primary for 30 feet and then just very short areas of really tough rough, the type of rough that players face every single day when they go out and play that thing for $40 or whatever, the average New Yorker. They had a very, very, very short area of real tough rough, and then the rest of it was trampled down by spectators. So everybody could hit shots from everywhere. And I guess he was thinking, his thought process was, we have guys who are generally longer than the European team, so what we'll do is keep this rough low so that they can get home in two from anywhere. We'll give them a chance to hit the green from anywhere and everywhere. But it backfired, because the Europeans were the ones who hit it on the green and closer to the hole throughout the first 2 days, and just enough on the final day to get that win. I don't agree with it at all. I think it was a course that was set up unlike the course was meant to be set up. When Tillinghast made that course, I think it is a course that was constructed to be a precision course, for you to find the fairways or for it to be a penalty or a very, very, very difficult shot. I have played that course before, and when you are in the rough, you are in trouble. Okay, and I think that's the way it's supposed to be. And in this rough, I'm telling you, you could see the ball. I didn't see one single time when a ball went into the rough and dropped down so far that you could not see the ball. Not once. Not once. And you could say that that's the case for the Sanderson Farms Open, okay, which I think is playing this week. You can say that for, you know, Kapalua or wherever else. You can say that for a lot of tournaments that get played with professional play, and that's where you see records get set. But you don't see that in major championships, and you sure don't see it in the Ryder Cup. I think it was a mistake to do that. I think that given hindsight, Keegan Bradley, and he's admitted as much to his credit, that he would have set up the course differently, that it would have been a more difficult course to play out of the rough, that he would have left it alone, so to speak. He would have just left it alone. Look, at the end of the day, I think that the way the Europeans were playing, had they played the same way for the course been set up different, they played the same way for the first 2 days, they would have ended up with the same lead. It was unbelievable the way they played, the fire that they played on foreign soil, no less. It was spectacular. But that course setup was something that was not right. It just didn't seem like Bethpage Black. It didn't seem like the course matched with the big warning that's at the beginning of the course, the big sign that says this is for experienced and excellent golfers only. It seemed like, yeah, you anyone can get out there and play that. And experienced golfers, go for it. And that's exactly what they did. It was still, nonetheless, it was a magnificent championship at a magnificent venue. I think that the course is sadly, grossly underrated in some of the ratings that you see in different magazines. They'll have it in the middle of the pack of public courses. I think it's one of the 10 best courses in the world, public or private. And if it was a private course, it would probably get a lot more notice, attention, and awards. But because it's a public course and because, you know, a pro can get out there and play it with a guy who hangs drywall, somehow that drops it down in prestige. Not in my mind. I think it is a genius setup and a wonderful and challenging course and should be ranked higher. Regardless. What you saw was outstanding play on days one and two, and heart and grit by the Europeans and by the Americans on day three. Look, everybody is to be commended on the course for their play, for what they did, for their enthusiasm, for their spirit. Even in the times where you had with Justin Rose, with his the putting thing with Bryson. I mean, Bryson is Bryson. You know, I mean, he knows it and I know it. We talked before, and look, I think the guy is 2 minutes into being a 3 minute egg. He's very enthusiastic about golf and very enthusiastic about who he is, but I think that he has some growing up to do. That's what I say. But, you know, who cares what I think? But, you know, even though we had that particular disagreement and dust up, they made up, they mended fences, and we still had one of the best golf tournaments, one of the golf events we're ever going to see. I think what it sets up is the return match in Adare Manor in Ireland, where you're going to have the U.S. playing on a course that is, despite the fact that Ireland has so many links courses, this is a parkland course. I've had a chance to play Adare Manor, and it is very much, again, it's very much like Augusta in terms of conditions. It is perfect. I mean, perfect. I mean, when I played it, it seemed like each one of the blades of grass is going to be numbered so they can be replaced at the end of the day. That's how much they are into perfection at that course. So you're going to see the American players be very comfortable there, I think, with that style of golf and that type of golf course. And we will see what they do then, who they bring. Is it the same team? Will there be differences? I think it will be different. For instance, I think Brooks Koepka will probably be there. By hook or by crook, Koepka will probably be there. And maybe some other players will not be. But I think when you look at the overall trend of where the Ryder Cup is, it is healthy. It is one healthy tournament. It is one event that everyone looks forward to for 2 years. As soon as the event is over, they're talking about the next one. And to me, that's the biggest sign of something that's healthy. When it's over, the first thing you're talking about is what's going to happen with the next one. Predictions started immediately after this one. So I guess in conclusion, I can say congratulations to the, well done to the U.S. players. The European players, again, just played out of their minds. But I can't not talk about the fans. Well, I was there on Saturday all day, and I saw the things that were said to the players, Rory in particular. And I have to say this. There were a lot of people who said that they were embarrassed by the U.S. They were embarrassed by the fans' behavior, by the things that they said, the way they behaved, the way they talked in people's backswings, the things that they said, that they brought them things to themselves to say. And I'll say a couple things about that. First, there's courage that comes from being in a crowd. You know, when you're standing in a crowd And you're doing that sort of, I've seen guys who would never say anything to anybody say the most ridiculous and inane and hurtful things because they know that they're in a crowd and they know that nobody's going to come after them and make them pay for it. So you have that type of mentality where people think that they're safe because they're in numbers. You had a lot of that going on out there. And then there's, of course, the drunken Yahoo who thinks that everything is okay to say because he's had, you know, three drinks before 12 o'clock. The bar's open at 9 there. 9 a.m. The bar's open. And look, I've been to a football game where the bar's open at 12. The game's at 8. By the time you get to your seat, there's 5 fights, you know, that are taking off, kicking off, you know, before the game's even started. And you're like, what? What the actual, right? But these are the guys that come to this event, despite the price tag. You get a bunch of people who come out and get very, very drunk and will say anything. So you guys who are guys who feel safe because they're in a crowd, and the guys who feel safe because they can't feel anything. So these are the guys you have to watch out for. And there were plenty of them there. And I don't feel embarrassed necessarily. I don't feel embarrassed. I just feel that something has to change. I don't feel embarrassed for them. They didn't feel embarrassed. I feel angry at them for taking away, for casting their particular manner, for casting their particular behavior over all of us. You know, people take what they did and say that, make a generalization about how all fans in the U.S. are. And that's just wrong, as all generalizations are. But I was particularly upset at these people. I was upset. I was just angry. I was pissed. It's like, why are you doing that? You know, what makes you think that it's okay to do that? Would you like that if somebody did that to you? People demand a certain type of behavior on a golf course. And people, I've heard people argue the other side and say, well, if you go to an NFL game, you hear all kinds of things and people are yelling and screaming and throwing. You know what? That's why they call it an NFL game. It's a whole different thing. It's like it's a whole different sport. You know, it has a whole different set of rules. And there are rules. There's just things that are done in a different way. And I think those levels are meant to be held to a higher standard for the Ryder Cup, not a lower standard. The idea of the Ryder Cup is to point out and to celebrate sportsmanship, not to disintegrate it, the very idea of it. And so much of this is relevant to what our whole culture is, you know, and I'm not going to be old guy on a porch and talk about all that stuff, but I think it serves as an indicator of where we are as a society. What we think of things like courtesy and rules and etiquette and things like that. Do they mean anything to some people at all? Some people, it doesn't matter to them until it applies to them. And I think that is maybe the overall takeaway from this is that there is a certain amount of selfishness that comes with people who are buying a ticket. It's the cost of it, they think, entitles them to do whatever they want to. It doesn't have to do with the fact that it's a rare find and that you're lucky to have it. They don't think, I'm lucky to get this thing. They get, I am blessed. I am amazing because I can afford this. And therefore, I have the right to behave any way that I want to. I think differently. I think that if you have the wherewithal to be able to get onto that course, you should have the presence of mind to be able to act like a grown-up. Like a grown-up. I mean, plain and simple. You may not agree with me. That's just fine. That's just fine. But if that's the case, I'll go play golf with you and I will holler some stuff at you like that which was hollered at the European team, Rory in particular, and let's see how you react. Let's see if we're still friends by the end of it. You know, everybody thinks a different way about these particular incidents. And I think that the Ryder Cup gives both the team and the nation it represents, the nations that are represented, the opportunity to show themselves for what they are. And in so many ways, the U.S. team showed what they are and what the U.S. is. And in so many ways, the fans showed something else. And for that, it's unfortunate. We shouldn't be talking about the fans at all, really. We shouldn't be talking about the fans at all. We should be talking about the play. We should be talking about what happened with the people who were participating in the tournament, not the people who were watching it. It shouldn't be a bigger story as it is. But the fact that it is means something. And I hope that people will take a moment. Most people won't. Let's be honest. People who did what they did will, you know, drink what they drink and do it again. That's just how it is. But hopefully we'll find a way to take a moment of reflection and be a little bit better the next time, because there will be a next time. So let's hope that we can be a little bit better the next time. The golf couldn't be better. It was spectacular. Congratulations to both teams on what they did. And I personally can't wait until 2027 in Adair Manor. As I say, it's a place that is not to be missed. And as Ferris Bueller once said, if you have the means, I highly recommend it. It's going to be spectacular. This was spectacular too. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to the great Adam Shupak about the 2025 Ryder Cup, what he saw, what he thinks, and what will happen in the next Ryder Cup. It's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to this. So go get another crunchy snack. Go get another beverage. I've talked enough. We got Adam coming up. Michael Williams, 19th hole. Welcome back to the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host, and I'm still digesting and decompressing from one of the most amazing events you will ever see, anybody will ever see, which was the 2025 Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black, the Europeans victorious 15-13. It was a show in every way, both on the course and off the course. Good news and bad news. There's a light side and a dark side. There's many, many different aspects to go over in this thing, and nobody better to go over it with than my good friend, the senior writer for Golf Week, Adam Shupak. Adam, welcome to the 19th hole. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. What a you know, the Ryder Cup, it never disappoints.
It never does it? It's you know, especially, it seems to get bigger and bigger as an event. You know, there's so much grandeur attached to it. There's so much anticipation attached to it. And when you get to the event, I mean, it's like a combination of the Super Bowl, the circus, and parade all at the same time. It's big. It's really big. So we can talk about all of that, too. We can talk about what happened on the course, off the course, all that good stuff. Well, let's talk about, first, start off with the course itself. As you looked at Bethpage, I don't know if you've had a chance to play it before. I have, and I've seen it before. But to you, what did the course look like, and did the setup please you? Did it satisfy you? Or did you think there were some tweaking that needed to be done?
I'm glad you started with this topic, because I needed to get some feelings off my chest. I was so disappointed in the way this golf course was set up, because I am a native New Yorker. You know that. Grew up Westchester County. So, you know, not out of the island, but I went out, you know, Bethpage Black is iconic, you know, for especially, you know, with the U.S. Open being there in 2002 and 2009. So this is a course that I would play, you know, at least once or twice a year. Yeah. And I didn't really do my ways around. I never slept in my car in the parking lot. Didn't do the, never had the authentic experience. But I will tell you, and all your listeners, Michael, this is one of the hardest courses in the world. It is such a beast, and they turned it into – I don't even know how it could have been made easy like this, but they made it into the Bob Hope Classic, and that's what bothered me so much is what were we doing? And I got to give a little – I respect Keegan Bradley that he apologized and took the blame for the course setup because they made it way too easy and played into the hands of the Europeans. And, you know, Eduardo Molinari, who's the kind of the data analytics and stats maven for the European side, when he got there, he said, wow, I couldn't believe they set it up, you know, the way they did. And there was no rough whatsoever. So there was no punishment for hitting it off target, which is such a big part of what makes that course hard is you gotta be on, you gotta be precise. That's what, you know, we had so many guys on our team that were, you know, they play well in the majors. We had the reigning U.S. Open champion, J.J. Spahn. You know, Scottie Scheffler is all about precision. All of a sudden, you know, for a lot of these guys, you know, Russell Henley, not the longest of guys. Colin Morikawa, still another guy who's about precision and not a bomber. And not guys that weren't, you know, known to be great putters. All of a sudden, it turned into a putting contest, and the Europeans, I didn't look at the final stats after Sunday, but going into it, I think it was like 8 or 9 of the top 10 in the putting stats for the week were the Europeans. Yeah. And they made everything. It was incredible. I could not believe – I knew they were going to make it so that there would be some birdies because nobody wants to just watch a bunch of pars and bogeys win holes. But – to make it the way they did where these guys were shooting 5-6 under in alternate shots just blew my mind. And I know the weather was part of the factor, and I couldn't believe that they would play lift clean in place, but this was not the Bethpage Black that is such a beast and a bully that I know.
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree with you. I got to the course, and I looked at the setup, and I said, this is Augusta without the trees. There was no rough to speak of. There was like a primary cut, and you had to go way out to get to some kind of like significant rough, like ferns and all that sort of garbage stuff that you typically associate with Bethpage Black. And after that, everything's been trampled down by spectators. There was virtually no trouble. And I just don't think it was a fair representation of what that course is. And by the way, I think you go out there in a month, and that course will play harder in a month than it did for the Ryder Cup.
Yeah. It was a bummer that happened, and it played so soft. And, you know, the fact that, again, that they played lift clean in place in an event like this, I thought, okay, the first day, yeah, it's somewhat understandable. But the next 2 days it was sunny, and I thought the course dried up enough that they could have played it down, and that was disappointing to me too.
Yeah, there were some interesting things about the course. I mean, the course itself, I think, I went over it last week with Reese Jones, hole by hole, and I think it's just an absolute masterpiece. It ends up in the middle of the top 100, I think largely because it's a public course. If it was a private course, I think it'd finish in the top 10 every year in the world. It's just a masterpiece. But the Euros were masterful in their performance, especially in the first 1 or 2 days. You saw all of this. You saw them go out in the team play in the first 2 days. What was it like to be there and watch them just rise to the occasion the way they did? I personally have never seen anything like it. I've seen a lot of Ryder Cups. I've seen a lot of team competition. I've seen a lot of individual competition. I've never seen anything like what they did those first 2 days of that competition. How did it strike you?
Yeah, I did think the Europeans were a really strong team and had picked them to win because I thought this was, you know, basically the same nucleus from 11 of the 12 players, and almost all of them were playing better or had better seasons in the last 2 years since they won at Rome. I knew it was going to be tough on the road, but they were so masterful, like you said, and were making so many birdies that they took the crowd out of it. They silenced the crowd. And it almost felt like they were playing like they were the home team, because there were a good number of European fans out there, and they were making a lot of noise, a lot of ole ole ole's, and you know, they've got the better songs. They win on that part of things. And I just thought it was really, I didn't think they could take the fans out of it the way they did. And I never imagined a 7-point lead after the first 2 days. That was incredible. Really one of the best team performances that I've seen in maybe ever.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about some of the signature shots, I think of a signature shot as the putt that Shane Lowry made when he was teamed with Rory. He made that putt on 15, and he wasn't really making anything all day long. And he finally made that putt on 15 to take that hole, and he just exploded. And that was sort of like what that team, when one player got cold, another player got hot. And it's not like the U.S. team played poorly. They played exceptionally well. But the European team played historically well. The captain, Luke Donald, how much credit do you give Luke Donald for what that team did on Friday and Saturday, how they performed?
A lot. I think he did. I think he went above and beyond. And, you know, I wrote a piece today saying, like, this guy sweat all the small details. I say, don't sweat the small stuff. Well, they didn't know about Luke Donald in this case, because this guy just was on top of everything. He talked about some of it after the fact, how he changed the bedding because he didn't like the sheets, and some light was coming in through the cracks of the doors. I mean, he changed the shampoo because he didn't like the smell and at the hotel. And it just, this is the guy who 2 years ago in Rome, learned Italian so he could speak it in his opening remarks, so that the people of Italy would love him. And he just did everything right. He knew his players, and he worked at this for the last really 4 years. And I think the continuity that team had was a huge factor in helping them pull off a very difficult task of trying to win on the road in the Ryder Cup.
And if you were going to pick out a player, I mean, the coach, exceptional. I totally agree with you. I think in a James Bond movie, Luke Donald would be M. He would be the guy who figures out all the little things that Bond needs to do to go out and put down Goldfinger. But when you look at an exceptional player, if you want to have an MVP for the first 2 days, can you pick one out, or is it sort of a collective effort? Everybody did spectacularly.
Yeah, maybe Tommy Fleetwood, you know, being 4-0, It really was, though, a bit of a collective effort. You know, you had Rahm doing what he does, and you know, he's still undefeated in foursomes, and he and Hatton have become such a good team. And I think that's one case where Liv has probably helped those guys, because they're a team on a regular basis, and have developed such a strong bond playing together over there. There were so many guys that were just doing great things, from Justin Rose to right on down. Are just so many guys that it's hard to pick out one. But what Tommy Fleetwood, being 4-0 and playing great with Rory, I think he was we've seen him do this before in the Ryder Cup. But, you know, having done it after winning the FedEx Cup, I think there's something with him that he's maybe going to the next level now that he got that W finally on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I agree with you there. By the way, we're talking to the great Adam Shupak. You're on the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host in Sherpa. So day one and two, we looked at the score sheet, and everybody was thinking about what they're going to eat at the golf course on Sunday, because it didn't look like it was going to be much of a match, much of a struggle. But yet, it was a struggle, an epic struggle, as it turns out. Do you know anything behind the scenes about what Keegan Bradley said or did, or what the U.S. players did to prepare themselves for that performance on day three? Or is it just what I always thought, that the Euros will do well in the team play, U.S. will come back and do better in the individual play, and the Europeans will end up ahead? Was it something different that he did, or was it just likely to play out in this scenario in all cases?
That's a good question. I think Keegan Bradley did keep the team together. They still believed in him going into the final day. And he came into the media center, and when he was asked, what did you tell the guys, he brought up Well, I was at Super Bowl 51 when my Patriots were down 28-3, and you know, I feel like to the Falcons, and he's like, we're down 28-3, and hey, they did it. Let's go make some history, guys. And I think to some extent the guys bought into that as much as they could at that point. And I think they have pride, so they came out firing. And I think also, you know, once you're down that much, you don't have much to lose. You don't play. I think they played tight the first 2 days, and they were able to kind of let it go. And I think that helped as well.
Yeah, I think when you look at it, there wasn't anything especially inspiring, I think, that Keegan Bradley said or did. I think his team was always set up to win the singles, the single pairings, rather than the team competition. But I think they weren't set up to be behind as much as they were going into the singles play. And
yeah
you look at the singles play, and by my count, the Europeans won exactly one match. I mean, I flat out won exactly one match. And
Ludwig Oberg took down Patrick Cantlay. That was it.
That was it. Everything else was a tie or a U.S. win. And I was looking at it. I was kind of shocked. Were you surprised by that performance, or was that what you expected? Did you expect it to be that close, I guess, is what I want to ask?
No, I didn't. I thought there was a better chance of Europe getting 20 points and this being just the most, the greatest blowout of all time.
Yeah.
Cause that's the way it was going. And, I mean, I think when we did some picks on Golf Week, I think I had it kind of more almost 6-6. I thought the U.S. would do better, but I really, it was impressive. Some of the performances, the way Cameron Young and Justin Thomas at the top of the order pulled out wins on 18, and then the comeback by Bryson from five down to at least get a half point was pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way things were going, I mean, I came back at after I was out watching Rory and Scotty, but after some point I got to get inside and sit down and write. And so I kind of had, you know, kind of knew it was a pretty good chance Europe was going to win. So I kind of had, you know, the basics of my story, you know, for first draft, buzzer beater story, as we call it, ready to go. But there got that moment where I was like, I got to start writing this is the greatest comeback of all time lead. I needed, you know what, you got to have, there've been a lot of great stories that have been, you know, written that have never seen the light of day because something crazy happens.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, here we go again.
Yeah.
And, it got nervy. I mean, that's what I give them credit for. They made Sunday special. And that's what I was so disappointed by going into Sunday, was I thought, man, we've waited 2 years for this day. This is one of the best days we ever get in golf. And it's not going to matter because this is a blowout. And they almost pulled off an incredible comeback.
Yeah. It almost seems like the Europeans left it in the team locker room, you know, on Sunday. They just were flat out exhausted from the effort of what they had done on Friday and Saturday. And that is especially showed up in the match with Fitzpatrick. You look at it and you just see him going five up and then just losing. It's just, it was really something to see with all these guys. So you look at it, and the guy who I really wanted to focus on was Scottie Scheffler, because here's a guy who went 0-4 for the first 2 days, did not win a single point. And I was thinking that this could be like a David Duval moment. You know, this could be one of those things that changes the arc of his career. And he got the point against Rory. He got the point on Sunday. We know how important it was to the Americans. It didn't ultimately lead to their win. How important do you think that point was to him personally as a player? Do you think something would have changed in him as a player?
I don't know. I think, you know, he's getting compared a lot, the things he's doing, to Tiger Woods. Well, the Ryder Cup's the one thing he doesn't want to be compared to with Tiger, because Tiger was never really that great.
Amen.
And for, you know, the match play is so different than stroke play, and, you know, we add in foursomes and the format. It's such a different animal than regular stroke play, which is where he does his best work. I don't know if he was I you know, one of the criticisms of Keegan Bradley was, what was he doing having Russell Henley tee off first in the on the first session of foursomes? They seemed to have been set up on the wrong holes, and they finally figured it out for when they played again the next time. I'm not sure I would have put Russell Henley back out with them again. I know they play great at the President's Cup, but man, JJ Spahn looked pretty good the first in four balls, you know. So I would have liked to have seen those, you know, JJ Spahn in the lineup over Russell Henley, who looked a little too nervous out there. A little like the moment was a little too big for him.
Yeah.
And he talked about it sure kind of felt that way on Sunday when he missed some critical putts late in his round. He played great. He played great in that match against Hatton, but you know, leaving that putt short on 18 and had a really good chance at 17. That could have, if he wins that match, that we really could have won this whole thing. And it just felt like it was there for the taking. And he just he talked about it. He said he never felt anything quite like it. And you know, he'll grow from that and learn from it. But boy, that was tough to see him come up a little short.
Yeah, he'll grow from it and learn from it, but he won't forget it. That's for sure.
Yeah,
he'll get reminded of it. And, you know, when we talk about the players in the American team, we can't not talk about Bryson DeChambeau and his match. Let me just say the Bryson thing, the Bryson attitude, the Bryson chip on the shoulder, the way he interacts with the crowd. Do you think he's a player who's made for this thing? And some will say that he's totally not made for it because of the way he is. And some will say he's totally made for it because of the way he is. Where do you stand on the Bryson DeChambeau and match play in particular?
Well, I think he's better on a home team. I think you take him on the road and man, he's going to catch a lot of grief. And you know, he's a guy who thrives on the energy of the crowd. And I think, you know, and if he's on the team in Ireland in 2 years trying to win the cup back, he is going to feel a lot of negative energy. I think it's going to be tough for him there. He was a big letdown. I mean, the fact that you know, we could criticize and second guess things that Keegan Bradley did. It's not his fault that Scottie Scheffler and Bryson DeChambeau were 0-7 hitting, you know, didn't get a single point going into Sunday singles. And you know, you got to have your guns. You got to have your big guns firing. And those guys did not come through this time. It's disappointing. I think some of it for DeChambeau was, you know, his partners didn't play really well with him. Yeah. And then he also had some opponents that kind of came through in the clutch when it mattered.
Yeah, I think you're right on all those counts. And Bryson, you know, we'll see coming forward. He's kind of like Tiger, and like, who do you match with that guy? Because he has so much energy. He draws attention to himself. And who do you really want to match up with that guy? Who really wants to be with him in the way that he carries himself and the way that he presents himself? I think it's tough to match him up with a player for the 2 days. But I could be wrong. We shall see, because the Adair Manor is only 2 years away.
I think the fact that he's on LIV makes it difficult, because he doesn't build relationships with these guys. He only sees them 4 times a year, and they're not really, you know, maybe I'll play some practice rounds with some of them that week, but you know, he's kind of in his own bubble. And he unlike where I said, I think it helps that Rahm and Hatton are teammates and spending so much time together and getting growing tighter. There isn't that person for DeChambeau, who is the only perp from LIV. And you know, Kepka kind of shot himself in the foot and wasn't able to, you know, be really considered for the team this year.
Right. I totally agree with all that, too. As we get to sort of the wrap-up thing, I just want to get a little hodgepodge of things that I wanted to go over. The missing player rule with Hovland not being able to play, Harris English, and splitting the point. Where do you fall on that thing? It's become a controversy. I say it's an issue that really doesn't really matter, but where do you stand on that? I think it's a big deal, not a big deal, somewhere in between?
I think it's an archaic rule, antiquated, that needs to be updated. I agree with Guy and Bradley on that. You know, when they conceived this like 50 years ago now, it probably made sense to do something, it's good sportsmanship to have this type of half point. But nowadays, I mean, I think they should have a 13th man who's one of the cart drivers and is a reserve in case something like this happens. They're part of the team, but they're, you know, only going to play under this particular circumstance because, you know, we wait 2 years for this. There's only 12 matches to take one of them away, to make one guy not get to play. There's just nothing. There's no upside to this. I just think it's a bad rule that needs to be changed.
Yeah, we haven't seen something like this happen for quite some time. And I agree that to have an alternate would seem to be an easy fix for this, an alternate or two for something like this. And I was surprised that it hadn't happened for quite so long, because something like this could easily happen when you have an injury or something like that. But yeah, it will be looked at, I'm sure, before Adair Manor.
And I think it was all on the up and up. I mean, they were up 11.5 to 4.5. You know, Hovland's a really good player. He was doing some pretty great stuff. I mean, the putt he made on 17 on
right.
the morning foursomes was huge to get that point and a win. And you know, I don't think they were trying to duck Harris English out there. Nobody asked Hovland a question, which I thought was disappointing from the press conference after. But I really wondered what he would have said if he was asked, hey, if you were going to have to forfeit, if it wasn't a half, would you have played? Like, would you have just, you know, gutted it out and tried? Because I really wonder, like, was there no way he could have played, or was it just like, very much a safety precaution and for his longevity of his career that was not good for him to play? I really wonder how he would have answered that.
That's a very interesting point because, I mean, we take the NFL, for instance, where guys routinely take a shot, take a pill, got to play. And this guy didn't have to play, but what if he did? Would he be willing to go a next step, an extra step to do that? Or would he still have taken the point or conceded a point if the rules were somewhat different? But it is what it is for right now, and we still got what we got. Let's see. We can't not talk about the fan behavior. So look, I was there on Saturday, which was, by all accounts, the worst day for fan behavior. It was a day where we saw so many things. I mean, the treatment of Rory, the treatment of this has all been documented out the yin yang in the papers, magazines that we all read. It's on the front page of CNN.com, for Christ's sake. Everybody's talking about it. The behavior of New York. In your opinion, I said that this was to be expected. This is what's going to happen in New York at Bethpage, especially with the crowd makeup that you had. Were you surprised at all at the fan behavior and what we saw on the golf course and what we saw and heard?
Yeah, I wonder, Michael, what do you think if there was less alcohol, or maybe even no alcohol? I mean, they're charging $750 a ticket. How much more money do they have to make on alcohol? I just think opening, you know, there was cheering when the bar opened at the pouring bars opened at 9 a.m. And I just think that has such a big factor in it. But it was embarrassing, and none of that belongs. It was like the Waste Management Phoenix Open out there, you know, maybe times 10. It was really... I've never seen a player take such verbal abuse the way Rory did. And, you know, I can understand how there are a few occasions where where he it crossed the line to an extent that he kind of made some comments back and just was got fed up, because there was I don't know how anybody could have withstood such a onslaught. It crossed the line, and I hope we don't see anything like that again. But it just seems like this. I don't think it really was the new. You know, I don't, as a New Yorker, I don't want this to be about the New Yorkers. I think it's just, I've seen this happen, you know, in Minnesota, and Chicago and Whistling Straits. I mean, this is how American fans act at these events on Saturday after a long day of drinking. It happens. Seems to happen every 4 years.
But here's the thing. I guarantee you that the people who are yelling at Rory and saying these horrible things to him and to his wife and throwing things at him and the whole thing, these are the same people who were in tears when he completed the career slam. You know, it's weird how this particular event has a Jekyll and Hyde effect on fans. It turns people from normal golf fans into some people, not everybody, let's be fair, some people into absolute monsters. And I don't know. To me, Rory's a guy who's genuinely loved in golf. He's so respected. He's so loved. People will chant Rory, Rory. But when he gets here, it's another thing. I don't know.
Yeah. I love the passion of the event, but when it starts shifting to the profane and getting personal, there was just too many jabs about his marriage and his wife and, you know, all that sort of stuff that just was uncalled for. And I really don't get why people feel that it's acceptable in this environment. And it's a change. I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but you know, they somebody made a great comment to me. They sell beer for like $4 at the Masters. Fans act responsibly. So maybe I'm wrong about it just being the alcohol. I don't know, but we need to get a little closer to treating this thing like the Masters and have some respect for the players. And you know, the part that really, I was out there Saturday morning when Rory and Tommy Fleetwood were having fans like deliberately yelling in their swing to try to distract them and cause them to hit bad shots. And that, you know, come on, they're playing golf. Like, let them play. I mean, let them hit their shots. If you want to say something after the fact that you don't want to boo, you can, I guess that's kind of become part of this whole thing. But I just thought that I was embarrassed for the fans.
Yeah.
The way they handle things.
I couldn't agree more. I was embarrassed. I was angry at some point, to be perfectly honest, at some people. And I have no official authority to do anything about anybody, but I was completely pissed off. And the fact that people were throwing things at Rory and his wife, I mean, you had a host, you know, who's saying F you know, to players that are getting ready to play. People have sort of lost it, you know, for what this tournament actually means. And it needs to be drawn back. And I guess I'll ask, do you expect to see anything different at Adair Manor? I kind of do, just because the nature of the fan and the nature of that place. Do you expect it to be any different?
That's, you know, I don't think they go to this extent. I think it's usually pretty comparable. You know, you'll get some tough stuff, but nothing like we saw that. I think nothing. It's not as personal and less profane over there has been what I've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Can we just simply say they're not New Yorkers, right? I mean, the New York to me has been, I think in many ways, is the friendliest city on the planet. I've had more kindness extended to me by strangers in New York than any place else in the world, guaranteed, full stop. And I think the saddest part is it doesn't represent the average New Yorker. It's not what New York is all about. That is a shame. So I hope that people can realize when they go to meet the average New Yorker, that's not your average New Yorker who's behaving like that on the course.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And it does leave it's a bad look overall for New York sports fans again. And, I saw Tom Watson apologized just said he was ashamed at the behavior. And I agree with him. And I respected that he came forward and did that, because I was a little surprised that Keegan Bradley, he was out there and he saw this stuff, and I thought he had to have seen some of the stuff, and he made it out as if, he didn't know what we were talking about when we were asking him about it on Saturday night.
Yeah. Yeah. He knew. He definitely knew. And he had some other birds chirping in his ear too, but he definitely heard it. We all heard it. But it didn't take away from a fantastic championship. It didn't overcome it completely.
Other moment that I thought was kind of funny is Sunday when I was walking with Rory's group, and Scottie Scheffler's dad was out there, and he heard some comments, and he would go up to these people and be like, "Stop it! Don't make him mad. You're just making him pissed off, and he's going to play better." Like, did you not see what happened yesterday? He knocked at the 2 feet when people were cursing at him.
Which is true. It seemed like the more angry that Rory got, the better he played. And
Both he and Shane Lowry were channeling their anger into some pretty amazing results. It was I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
Yeah, they sure did it. And I'm sure Shane is he is challenging his way through some incredible amounts of beer right now, if I know Shane at all. but it was a magnificent championship. It was really something to see. It just makes me all the more anxious to see what's going to happen at Adair Manor. And almost certainly, we'll get a chance to talk before then. You going out to play any golf soon?
Yeah, actually gonna play heading to Amelia Island tomorrow with my wife. We're gonna play Oak Marsh, which just had a renovation. They got a short course there as well at the Omni in Amelia Island, and we're headed to Portugal for a golf trip, but had to postpone that, and just some stuff going on that decided to just do a little closer to home short-term trip, I'm pumped. I can't wait to play and have a little get to see the work that's been done to this golf course. It's been a while since I've been there, so that should be a good time. And it's been I haven't had the clubs in my hand enough lately, so I'm anxious to get out there and see how it all goes.
Well, I don't believe a word of it. When I go and play with you, I'm going to leave my wallet in the car, okay? So you get my money. You're not going to get it. Adam, so great to talk to you, man. Loved chatting with you. Thanks for your perspective and taking the time to do this. And can't wait to talk to you some more and to get out and play with you again soon.
Anytime. You're my man.
You got it, man. That is Adam Shupak, senior writer for Golf Week. Look, we can see a lot of different things and say a lot of different things about this tournament, about this event, the Ryder Cup. Ultimately, what happens off the course is just gossip, and it's a lot of stuff. What happens on the course is what the real story is, and what you saw is an epic matchup of two great, great teams with some great, great golf being played on all 3 days. And hopefully, when we get to the next Ryder Cup at Adair Manor, you'll see the same thing. There'll be a lot of talk about it. I've had a chance to play that course too. We'll talk about it a lot over the course of the next 2 years. But look, what happens off the course, that's a thing that'll be dealt with along with a lot of other things. But it's the golf that keeps us talking. That's what we're talking about, the golf, the golf, the golf. And it was really spectacular. Congratulations to the Euros. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more golf and stuff. Michael Williams, 19th hole. Well, boys and girls, that's it and that's all for this edition of the 19th hole. I want to thank my very special guest, Adam Shupak of Golf Week. He is a just an absolute fountain of knowledge, and I love to hear what he has to say, the way he thinks about it. He's both spontaneous and thoughtful, which is a tough thing to be and to do, and he does it better than anybody. And I hope that you had some thoughts about the Ryder Cup and what it was and that sort of thing. Would love to hear from you. You know how to get in touch with me. And, you know, let me know what you think. You know how I think. Let me hear what you got going on. You can hear this show on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, and other great locations where wonderful podcasts are located. Again, thank the guests and thank you for listening. It was an amazing week of golf. We'll be back with more because golf never ends, as we all know. We'll have more next week. So until then, go out, play some golf. And when you do, you know, grab a new club. You know, there's a lot of new stuff coming up there, but try to do something that helps you to hit them straight. Michael Williams, 19th hole.